Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here in Building 43. Is that right? Is this where your office is?
It is. This is my conference room.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. This is pretty amazing. Yeah. So, like, I tried calling the other day, but the number you gave me was, like, some pizzeria. Was that on purpose?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. We're here to talk about...
I was hoping you wouldn't ask.
Yeah, I know. Now it gets awkward. We're here to talk about blockchain, speaking of awkward, because the first time I heard about blockchain, I totally didn't understand, and I put out on Twitter, why is this even important? And I thought I would ask you, because we work on this stuff. Some people answered. They said distributed ledger, and then they said finance stuff, and then they said, like, I just didn't have a good sense for why blockchain would be important, so I thought I'd ask you.
All right.
So tell us, why is blockchain important? How do I even start thinking about what it is?
Yeah. I think to get to the answer to that question, we should cover some of the fundamentals of blockchain.
Let's do it.
And when you talk about blockchain, you've got to reference really what created the whole blockchain movement, which was Bitcoin and Satoshi Nakamoto's paper that and code that launched Bitcoin. And the purpose he had in mind was to create a cryptocurrency that had no central governing authority. And if you think about that, all the currencies that we've got today are called fiat currency. There's some government that backs it and stands behind it and has assets that they can, you know, deliver value into the into the currency. In the case of a distributed currency where there's no central authority, you've got a few challenges. One is keeping track of who's got what. Another one is everybody agreeing about who's got what. And when you don't have anybody central, that means that everybody's got to agree together on the state of, I've got this amount of coin, you've got that amount of coin.
Yeah, and it feels like I would always say I have more, right?
Yeah.
And you would always say you have more. So how do you enforce this?
That's right. And then you've got this other problem with anything that's keeping track is we all need to have a pretty consistent view of what's going on, because you don't want it that I can come to you and say, hey, here's 5 coin, and then you take it from me and give me, you know, something interesting, like a nice camera.
Sure.
And then I turn around and I take that same 5 coins and give it to somebody else, because it's digital, so it's not like I've given you something physical and I could then turn around and give it to somebody else and get something for the same 5 coins.
I see.
And then if the whole network decided that the 5 coins I gave this other person were the valid transfer, then you're out your camera and I'm gone.
Oh.
And in the public network, everybody's anonymous too. So it's not like, you know, we can send law enforcement after somebody typically.
So it feels like this is the distributed system of some kind.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's got to be some fun data structure involved with this in order for it to make it work.
You've got a whole bunch of challenges. Another one is scale, because you want this to support, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people that are transacting on this, you know, transacting with each other. So Satoshi came up with this idea of a blockchain. And the foundation for blockchain is cryptography.
Okay.
And there's a couple fundamental cryptographic operations that underlie everything in Bitcoin and other blockchains. And one of them is hashing. So hashing is taking a block of data and creating what's called a digest of that data, that is a small representation of it. And one of the counterintuitive things about this is you can take a ton of data and then you can create a very small digest, like a 64-byte digest of it. And yet you can take millions, billions of different blocks of data, and each one will have a unique digest. And that's one of the cryptographic properties that make digests useful, is that it's very hard to get a collision between two digests, at least with the modern hashing algorithms like SHA-256.
Mm-hmm.
And another cryptographic property that blockchain's built on is signing. And signing is, I can take the digest for a block of data, and then I can use a cryptographic key to create a signature for that, such that my key that I use to sign it is paired with a key that I can give you that can be, you can then look at it and prove that, or validate that I signed this hash with my private key that you never see.
Uh-huh.
So it's this public-private key pair where I keep the private key to myself, I can sign things, and then other people can verify that I signed them by using the public half of that key.
So far what I'm understanding is there's this thing called a digest, there's this thing called a block,
yep.
and there's this thing called signing.
Yep.
So I understand the notion of signing so that people can verify, I really did give you the 5 coins, so please give me the camera.
Yep.
But what I don't understand is how the digest and the blocks help everyone else know that use this currency actually prove that to everyone else.
Yeah.
Look, he can't give you the same 5 coin that he gave me.
Yep. So let's get into that, and that relates to the blockchain in general.
Cool. Well, let's get a marker. Where to go? Okay. Good.
Marker here.
Perfect.
Handy.
Perfect.
I carry around with me all
of course.
The time.
I mean, always in the back pocket. Right? Yeah. Nice.
So if you take a look at transactions, the transaction is, you know, Mark gave Seth 5 coin.
Mm-hmm.
Seth 5 coin. Mm-hmm. And that transaction, I want everybody to agree that that is what actually occurred. What you've got in a blockchain is this history of everybody's transactions. So everybody starts out with some coin, and we'll get to how coins get minted in a second. But let's just say everybody's got a certain amount of coin. And when you've got this coin right here, the way you want to, if you want to give that 5 coins to somebody else, you digitally sign this,
mm-hmm.
and you with another transaction that says Seth wants to give, you know, George 5 coins, and you sign the hash of this previous transaction and the public key of George,
mm-hmm.
which says I or Seth is actually giving George these 5 coins. Mm-hmm. And you're proving that you own these 5 coins by referring to the previous transaction that shows you've got those 5 coins. And that's by hashing that. So somebody can go back and look, oh, in fact, Seth was given 5 coins by Mark, so, and he's transferring them to George because he signed George's public key.
And only
George can unlock that now, because you're signing this transaction with your private key. So, you know,
I see.
So key... private.
So let's see if I understand this, because
this is Seth's key, right?
So let's just pretend like we got to this state. And the cool thing about this is because there was this mathematical proof, I don't remember what it was called, where you have to prove the first thing, you have to prove n,
yeah.
and then if you can show n plus 1, then it proves all of it. So if we can get to this state, I mean, it's an inductive proof.
Yep.
Mathematical induction proves that if you're good here, then you're going to be good forever.
That's right. And you can actually trace this all the way back, right? If you want to validate, yeah. you know, did Mark really have 5 coins? Well, Mark signed this with the hash of the previous transaction and Seth is public key. And so this is what forms a transaction chain.
I see. So let's see if I understand. So let's just say everyone agrees that this transaction's good. Now yep. I want to give the 5 coin you gave to me to George. What I have to do is I have to send, am I getting the hash of this and putting it here?
Yeah, you're putting the hash of this here. So basically the hash
it's like a pointer back.
Of that. And then you're signing it, this whole thing. Here's George's public key.
Uh-huh.
So this is George key public.
Uh-huh.
You're signing that. So then a signature.
And so only George
you're
can pull this out.
With this, right. So only George now... the way that he's going to use those coins, of course, is creating another transaction, right? At this point, these things belong to George. Only George can use them. But to use them, George has to create another transaction, of course, and then refer back to that, too, with a hash of that signed with the public key of somebody else, like, say,
Sally,
Veronica,
yeah.
and the number of coins that you want to give, and then this has to be signed with George's private key.
Okay.
And that transfers the money then to Veronica.
So I understand this.
Yep.
What I don't understand is how are you, me, George, and Veronica all in consensus that this is the way things happen?
Yep. And that, for that, we've got to talk about blocks.
Okay.
And the generation of blocks of transactions.
Okay.
So this is what where we get the name blockchain.
Okay.
Because you take all the transactions that might occur during some period of time and put them into a block, and the block then refers with a hash to the previous block, and it's a hash of this whole block, represents a block in the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got these hashes that link things together, you can always go back and say, oh, this transaction, which might be, you know, this is transaction 1, transaction 2, transaction 3. Transaction 1 might have been in this block. This might be transaction 2. And these blocks then, we can are, you know, these transactions are referring to each other across the blocks, but we don't, we batch the transactions in these blocks. And the transactions are embedded in them, and then they refer, you know, back to previous blocks where the transaction chain exists. And by the way, I want to make one thing clear, that you can actually have transactions that, you know, split the coin.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so this is what everyone has on their machines then?
Yeah, this is what everybody's got on their machines. But, and your question was, how do we achieve consensus about these? This is the actual order of transactions. Uh-huh. And that's the fundamental problem that Satoshi was faced with, that he solved with this kind of clever distributed consensus algorithm, which is known as mining.
Okay.
So, and a lot of people that have know about Bitcoin have heard about mining and miners, and you can actually go stand up your own miner and try to mine blocks.
Which I tried to do, but apparently the power that it takes to make you mine a Bitcoin is not even worth
that's
a bit.
Right. So the process of mining is one that is designed to have everybody achieve consensus. Nobody trusts each other. Anybody can try to mine a block, but if you mine a block that says, you know, that Seth gave, you know, Mary, that 5 coin, and then you mine another block that says you gave it to George, like, you've basically taken those 5 coins and you've done 2 different things with them, and then the whole network has to decide which one is valid.
Right.
And in fact, because it's anonymous and public, there's bad actors out there that are like going to try to fork the blockchain and double spend their money.
Sure.
That's the fundamental problem you want to prevent from happening. You can't spend somebody else's coin unless you
sign
with their private key. So unless you get their private key, which you can, if you don't handle your private key properly, like storing it in in a wallet, for example, a digital wallet that protects it, that's a risk there. But if you protect that, the only kind of scam that you got here is double spending money. So how do you ensure that we only have one view of which of these blocks is valid? And the answer is, first of all, to be able to mine a block, you've got to solve this cryptographic puzzle that is computationally intensive. That cryptographic puzzle is generating a hash. So this includes, this is the hash of the previous block here. Uh-huh. Like I said, this is the hash of this block. But one of the, there's a field in the block called a nonce that you can assign whatever value you want to. But the trick is that the hash of this block, which includes the transactions, the hash of the previous block, and this nonce, has to be below a certain value.
Okay. Now
in other words, it has to have a certain number of leading zeros. So
okay. The
hash is a certain number of bits wide, and there's a target. It's like the cryptographic puzzle you got to solve is find a hash of all of this that has a certain number of leading zeros. That's the puzzle in Bitcoin. And the Bitcoin system is designed such that based on how fast people are mining blocks, that it's going to take about 10 minutes to do that. And basically, it's just a roll of the dice because you can't predict hashes.
No.
So effectively, it's like, let me try with a 0 here. Let me try with a 1 there. Let me try 2. Let me try 3. Let me try 4. And so it becomes a race. Everybody's got different versions of the, you know, different blocks with different transactions in them. They all have the same hash of the previous block. And then they're all sitting there messing with their nonces, trying to solve the puzzle as fast as they can. And then some miner is going to solve this puzzle first, and then they distribute the block and say, I came up with a hash, solves the puzzle. Here, everybody look at it. And everybody else in the network, like you, look at it and you go, yep, you solved the puzzle. So I'm going to treat this as the next block in the chain.
Which is a collection of transactions.
Yep.
That's been hashed.
Yep.
So, like, maybe this isn't a good video to get into it. Maybe we can talk about it some other time. I'm having a hard time understanding, like, the mathematics of, like, why a certain number with a certain leading number of zeros is a hash. But let's just say there is a proof. What you're effectively doing is you're validating a block.
Yep.
And what is it that you get out of it? Just the nonce?
Well, actually, what you're doing is the nonce is just there to create a puzzle to where that's kind of random. Because the idea is, we need one block to actually be the one that we all agree on is the next block. And everybody's got blocks that they're proposing. We need to have some kind of lottery to decide whose is the next one. And that lottery is this cryptographic puzzle that takes about 10 minutes to solve. Somebody's going to solve it, and then they're going to win the lottery. And this is the block that everybody then decides is the next valid one.
I see. And and maybe you can link these two ideas together for me, because this is where I'm wondering. Because when I mine a Bitcoin, I'm getting some value out of it. What's the value that I'm getting out of
it? Yeah, so that's a great question, because this is computationally expensive, and it's getting more and more computationally expensive all the time to actually have any chance of winning this thing. If you've got a little computer, you know, have a server today, and you're just running through this, there's almost zero chance. There's a chance, but almost zero chance that you're actually going to solve the puzzle before.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Anybody else. Yeah. But really what miners are looking at this is an economic return, because what comes out of this is there's an artificial transaction at the beginning of this thing, which is give me, so if it's your miner, you put a transaction there that says give Seth the coin that the network has agreed whoever wins the lottery earns. So there's a certain number of Bitcoin that you earn for just having won the lottery.
And this is crazy, because you are economically incentivizing people to agree on what happened.
Yeah, and actually to agree to go try to solve this puzzle, right?
Yeah.
To throw computational power at solving this puzzle, you incentivize them with this, hey, if you win, you get some Bitcoin. So it is like a lottery in that sense.
Interesting. And like the thing that I like about this is Bitcoin has been going up steadily for a while now. What this is saying is that there's two different problems. One is we need to have everyone agree on transactions. And two, we need to have a data structure that everyone agrees on, and we need to have a way for people to move stuff around. But the thing that I like is that the way that people agree on things, people have an economic incentive to make sure they're right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
There's there's this question, because the fees, so these coin bases shrink over time, designed into the Bitcoin protocol. After a certain number of blocks, this amount of money or amount of Bitcoin somebody gets for winning halves. So there's this question of what happens if that incentive gets too small. And then what the system also allows is transaction fees, where if you said, I give Veronica 4 Bitcoin, but there were 5 here, by default, that extra Bitcoin that you didn't spend out of this transaction goes to the miner. So that's another way to incentivize.
And that was the other question, because I heard that these things, there's not much more incentive to actually get money for block mining. Now you're saying that everyone has agreed to, look, if someone mines this block, they're going to get certain factors.
And so what will happen if this gets too small, the Coinbase incentive gets too small, then and you want your transaction to be processed on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin network, you're going to have to put in some fees. The whole network will kind of settle on, this is the fee for you to actually get your transaction mined in a reasonable amount of time.
I see.
Because the miners will look at the transactions, and there's kind of, they each can independently pick which transaction. So the transactions are broadcast around the network. So all the miners see transactions, but they can decide which ones to put in their block that they're gonna mine. And the blocks have a certain fixed size. So they'll say, I'm gonna take these 1,000 transactions, put them in the block, and I might have 2,000 transactions that I've received. I'm going to take 1,000 of them. Which 1,000 do I take? The kind of good behavior is I take old ones and I take high value ones. And then you might, as a secondary thing, take ones with high fees.
I see. So, which brings up the next question, because it kind of simulated this question. These blocks, do they have a fixed size for transactions that you have to put in? And then the other question is, like, how does someone decide which transactions? Is it monetary based?
Yeah.
Is it just pick whatever?
Yeah, it's just that, exactly what I just said.
Yeah.
So out of the 2 transactions I might have, I take the 1,000 oldest ones that are also, and then sort by the amount of the transaction, how many coins are being transferred.
Mm-hmm.
Take the big ones first, and then the small ones. That's the general kind of way. But nothing stops a miner from picking whichever ones out of the transactions that are submitted to the network picking whatever ones they want to.
So as let's just say I'm working on this, someone solves a puzzle, is there like a broadcast that says, here's the new block?
Yep.
And then I get that block, attach it to the previous one, because I'm assuming
in my own view of it.
And then can I see the transactions in there, so I stop working? Like, okay, these 500 transactions are already in this block. Let me work on these 500 that I was already working on, plus another 500.
That's exactly. If you're a miner and you get the block, somebody's won the lottery, the best is to not try to win and I'll talk about conflicts in a second. But what you do is say, those 1,000 transactions in there, those are done if I had any of them that I was trying to mine, you know, remove those, and now I'm going to go try to mine the next block and win that, and I'll put the transactions that are left and the new ones that have come in into this next block and try to mine it.
So speaking of conflicts, yeah. Let's just say in the off chance, two blocks get the puzzle solved,
yep.
But they have different transactions in them.
Yep.
How do you fix that?
That's another challenging question, because there is possibility that as the network's distributed, there's different miners in different parts of the world that solve the puzzle approximately the same time, broadcast their answers to the network, and then you, with your own Bitcoin node, get these two blocks, you know, one, and then you get the other one, and you're like, oh, both of these are valid. Which one do I pick? What you do at that point in time is you just pick one of them arbitrarily, and then you wait for the next block to get mined. And if the next block that gets mined is on top of the one you didn't pick, then you've made a mistake, and you've got to go back and undo what you did.
Oh.
And say, oh, it's not this block that won, it's that one. And because I just got a broadcast to me, another block that referred to this one. The principle is the longest chain wins.
I see. So what happens to the Bitcoin that this person mined? Doesn't exist.
That all those transactions become invalid. The whole network agrees that the long chain wins. This block is no longer valid. Which brings up an interesting question, which is, let's say you're a miner and your transactions in there, so somebody's transactions in there, which is, you know, Mark gave Seth 5 coin.
Yeah.
There's a risk here that this block has Mark gave somebody else those 5 coin. And if you, at that point, gave me the camera, and then you later got this chain right here, which is longer, the whole network's agreed on this. Basically, the network's decided, no, Mark didn't give you 5 coin. He gave Veronica yeah. 5 coin, and now you're out your camera. So there's this basic protocol that you follow, especially when you're dealing with something expensive like a camera, is you wait for a certain number of blocks to get generated. And your transaction that you're interested in here is Mark gave Seth 5 coin. It has to be a certain depth in the chain before you's like, okay, nobody's going to come. And the chance of another chain that's longer being generated, because there's so much computational power required to undo what just had gotten done, is close to zero. So I'm going to now give Mark the camera.
I see.
Generally on the blockchain network for high value transactions, it's like 6 blocks, which is about an hour. You wait, you know, change, this thing is 6 deep in terms of blocks, and then you're like, okay, Mark, here's your camera.
So this is, like, I feel like I'm understanding this a lot better. I mean, it's really clever how this works, but aside from, like, trying to get Bitcoins out of it, why would a business be interested in this aside from, like, making money?
Yeah, okay, great question, but to answer that one, let me talk about another public blockchain
cool.
network that's actually pretty popular. It's called Ethereum.
Okay.
And Ethereum, so Bitcoin was designed for cryptocurrency from the start. It's got this basic scripting engine in it that's very primitive, and so people have gotten clever and built other applications, kind of applications or coins on top mm-hmm. of it. Like there's a DNS system that's built on top of it. But the capabilities are limited. And the Ethereum blockchain is much more general. So it's got this concept of smart contracts
okay.
or distributed applications where you can have a piece of code that lives in the blockchain. And that piece of code it's a language called Solidity mm-hmm. and it looks a lot like any other standard programming language, can perform some modifications taking as inputs other transactions on the chain. And it also has its own state. So it got its own basically store of key values.
I see.
So as it gets executed and the smart contract transactions go into the chain, they morph the state of the smart contract.
And so a smart contract is a data structure with some actions like code on.
That's right, yep. With property and methods on them.
Yeah. I see. And so, like, I'm trying to understand, like, the value. Why would that be a value? Because I understand yeah. getting value out of that. And I understand that what's happening is everyone's agreeing on these actions and these nouns.
Yep.
What does that look like in practice? Like,
So let's say that one of the common cases people talk about for this is, like, let's take real estate,
okay.
where I'm giving you some real estate, but I need to have proof that, you know, the inspector said that the thing was good. Mm-hmm. And so you can write a smart contract that codifies logic, contractual logic. such that an inspector has to come in and basically submit evidence to the smart contract that they've looked at the property and said it's good. You've identified which inspectors are valid. And then you can look at the smart contract state, and when it hits that those conditions, it actually transfers this asset, which is part of the smart contract, to you.
I see. So the state would be inspected, the action would be transfer property,
yep.
And then what happens is as these blocks are being mined, that state is being verified by everyone.
Exactly.
In the
so the and the fact that it's distributed, everybody sees this, everybody knows, oh, you know, Mark sold his property to Seth, and this inspector had looked at it, and mm-hmm. Seth was good with that. And now everybody sees that. So it's like this code that executed the contract. It's visible to everybody. We all see it. So there's no, you know, middleman. It doesn't get lost.
And there's no way for me to say this didn't happen
exactly.
Because it was cryptographically signed. The hashes were matched, and
yep.
Everything is in there.
And everybody validated it, right.
So how does someone, for example, in Ethereum, why would they mine the blocks here, right? Because there's
yeah.
no currency anymore.
Well, actually, yeah, that's a good question. Ethereum has got its own kind of money
okay.
called Ether, which is not designed to be a cryptocurrency. It's designed to be what's called fuel for the smart contracts on the blockchain. And so if you want to submit a smart contract, if you want to execute a smart contract, or you want to add a smart contract to the blockchain or add transactions, you've got to pay for it with Ether. Or enough gas,
right.
It's called actually in Ethereum terminology. You've got to say, when I execute the smart contract, here's some gas. And now the nodes know that, hey, Seth, to execute the smart contract is actually putting money behind it. So I'm going to go and run the algorithm, which could take some computational resources.
Uh-huh.
If I win the block, I'm going to get compensated for that because I get this money from, you know, this gas, this ether from Seth.
Uh-huh.
So the miners are trying to solve the cryptographic puzzle, which is a different one than Bitcoins. And they get the ether from the gas of the transactions that they perform, they execute.
And that would fuel additional smart contracts.
And there's also some Coinbase in that too.
I see. Okay, so the question I have then, because this is a business thing, what if I don't want people to know what my real estate transactions have been, number one? Number two, am I waiting hours for these things to finish up, right?
Yeah.
And then number three, like, who gets to be involved in this, like, these contracts? Obviously, like, I don't want, like, Joe Schmo
yeah.
to be at his home, like, I'm mining block for Ethereum. Oh, look, Seth did a transaction for
yeah.
real estate. Like, how do we, tell me about those problems and how those are solved.
So a couple things. It's a public network, so anybody can submit smart contracts. You can put rules on the smart contract that says who can invoke the smart contract
okay.
by, you know, checking for the signing keys on them, for
okay.
example. So you can prevent somebody from using your smart contract. You can prevent. You can specify in what smart contracts can do and can't do. In fact, there's a whole kind of best practices of writing smart contracts that can't be abused by people out on the network.
I see.
You've got to be very careful because once it's out there, and if it has a flaw in it that like takes the asset that says this is Mark's property and gives it to somebody else instead of Seth,
yeah.
Violating kind of what you wanted the smart contract to do, you're screwed. I mean, now everybody
yeah.
sees that it belongs to this other person and it's really hard to get it back. In fact, there's been several high profile cases of people screwing up and losing hundreds of millions, you know, tens of millions of dollars
Ooh.
With bugs in their smart contracts.
Okay, so.
But you brought up another question. It's like everybody can see everything that's
yeah.
going on. In fact, they have to just by nature of it, because when your miners get these blocks, they've got to go and execute and make sure it's a valid block,
right.
you know? Because you're a miner, and you tell the world, oh, I solved the puzzle, here you go. Now, you might have solved the puzzle, but you put in crap in there.
Yeah.
And you put in bogus stuff in there. And so everybody needs to go and validate all the transactions, make sure that they all refer back to previous ones that are valid. And in the case of Ethereum, they actually have to go run the smart contracts and make sure
that
the state changes that were in this block actually match what came out of the smart contract.
So that's even more computationally expensive.
That is. But that's the validation, which leads to this requirement that everything has to be visible to everybody else. So it's pseudo-anonymous in the same way that Bitcoin is. We don't know, there's no names behind these things, but you can actually see keys, the use of keys, and kind of trace things. And And you, the smart contract code's all very is visible to everybody.
Okay.
So I can see that this entity identified with this key, public key, gave some, this asset through the smart contract to this other one.
Okay.
And that even by itself is not confident, not private enough for some people. It's pseudonymous, and actually, if there's any kind of hint, you get any kind of hook into, this key actually belongs to Seth. Then you can kind of go back into the blockchain, and then you can watch, Seth's use and the connections. Like, if I know that this was Seth, well, Seth gave coin to these things, and actually, one of these might actually be Seth with a different key. But I can kind of see the ripples of what Seth did on the blockchain.
And it's not even like a nefarious thing. I might be having like a really good trading algorithm that I want to execute, and I want to make sure there's a ledger that I'm trading securities with people. I don't want people knowing how I'm trading, right? Yep. Because, it's a financial incentive to me. And so, I guess you got to be careful with these things.
Yeah. So, and even in the Ethereum blockchain network, it can take tens of minutes before you actually, have something deep enough where you're going to trust it.
Awesome. I like that. I mean, this is a really good first parter. We've been learning all about blockchain.
Yep.
We learned about Bitcoin and how this works. We learned about how businesses can use a blockchain with Ethereum. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, bud.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Seth.
Thanks so much for watching. We're here with Mark Rusinovich learning about some awesome blockchain things. We'll see you next time in part 2 of this video. We'll talk about something that we're doing on Azure with this.
Yeah.
See you then.